Blog Talk Radio.
And welcome everybody to the Dragon's Lair. Tonight's topic is, again, the paranormal. This is part two. The setting is Russia. Once again, paranormal does not mean occult or supernatural. It has nothing to do with religion of any kind. The definition of paranormal is that which demonstrably exists but lies outside the accepted normal of the society and culture that surrounds it. Therefore, it is to be investigated and not relegated to the realm of superstition. For the record, today is October 25th, 2013, on our screwed-up Christian calendar. The sun is at 3 degrees Scorpio. Again, I have no personal website or blog. If you want to get in touch with me, you can reach me at magus_18@geocities.com. That is magus_18@geocities.com. If you want to be on my e-list, just send me an email saying subscribe, or you can just write me. I can't guarantee that I can answer all of my emails, but I will read all of them. Again, no calls tonight. The cat is on the back of the chair. The dog is tied up in the front yard. Now, if he decides he wants to start barking at a cat and making a lot of noise and waking up the neighbors, I'll have to pause the show and play some music and bring him inside, but hopefully he won't be a problem. I like leaving him outside as much as I can, and this, the weather's really nice. I've got my front door wide open right now, and weather here is just really great. I love this time of year. So anyway, tonight I've got a couple of photos up that are rotating on the Blog Talk page for the show that I want everybody to take a look at. And one of them I will be doing a story on. I'll let you know to go look at it, you know, right before I read that story that it's related to. The other one I'll talk about a little bit. You'll see one where you kind of see the profile, you know, the side view of someone or something's head. It's white. You know, it could be perhaps ectoplasm. I'm not sure. But you'll also see this swirl off to the top right. And I took that photo. Now, when I snapped that photo, I could not see any of that in front of me when I took that photo. And let me give you the background on that. Most of you know my business is architectural and structural engineering. Well, I was doing work for somebody else at the time, and one of our clients was in Alexandria, Louisiana. They have a chain of hotels across part of the country anyway. I won't say which chain. But the particular one that was going to need the work done on it was in Alexandria, Louisiana. And Alexandria is roughly south central Louisiana. And Louisiana is in Mississippi, is well known for haunted houses and stuff like that. A lot of it related to the war of northern aggression. People die before their time, kind of thing, I guess. So anyway, this hotel was partially gutted. The rooms were all still intact, and the main lobby was still intact, and you know, about one half of the one side of it was still usable, but the other half, where there was the sort of a convention center room area, you know, and the kitchen and a huge dining area and of course a bar. Most hotels have some kind of a bar in them. And that area was gutted and was slated to be remodeled. And, of course, you know, you have to draw the plans as is or as built, as the proper terminology is, so that whenever, you know, you get ready to design something new, you've got something to work from, you know. And, of course, the when you submit it for permit, they want to be able to see what's there already. And when we got there, it was just me and the other guy that I was working with. We did the whole hotel in one day. And, you know, that's field measuring, photographs, you know, laying the thing out by hand on paper, you know, roughly, you know, with all the dimensions and stuff on it, the field measurements. But before we got going, he kind of took a bunch of pictures on the inside, and I went on, he took pictures on the outside, rather, and I took pictures on the inside, and I went into the gutted area, took all the pictures that I could, that I needed, and I've done plenty of restaurants before and stuff, and so, you know, knowing that was sort of an area that I excelled in, he took the outside photos and sent me in to do the kitchen and bar, etc. And there was nobody in there. And I went in there and, you know, just kind of started looking around. And, you know, I had my camera with me and something to write on, et cetera, tape measure. And I was just kind of looking around and I heard what sounded like something really like a heavy piece of metal hit the concrete. And I thought, well, maybe somebody else is in here. So I kind of looked around where I heard the sound, and I didn't see anybody or anything, and thought, well, okay, maybe something fell. And then I went on about what I was doing, and a little bit later I heard what sounded like the same noise, only perhaps maybe the metal was a little bit more clear. It sounded more like chains, perhaps. You know, some thick, heavy chains were hitting the concrete. And I said, is anybody there? Nobody ever answered. And I looked around. I couldn't find anything. It looked like it had fallen. So I thought, oh, well, okay. And I've never had any sort of a paranormal experience before. That, you know, this is actually the first of any kind that I could say that I've never even come close to having. And I've never seen a ghost or an apparition or ectoplasm or anything like that. And so went on about my business, took all the photos, took measurements that I could without having to have somebody hold the tape measure. And when I got to the bar area, the bar seating area, I stood on one end and took a photo looking down towards the other end of the bar. And believe me, that was really an important photograph that I needed. And I found out later when I got back to Houston and put all the photos on the computer and started drawing on everything. It's like, damn, I really needed that photo. But anyway, when I snapped that photo, you know, I had a clear view of the end of the bar. There was nothing there. But again, we went on about our business. I didn't think anything of that, and we went ahead and measured the rest of the hotel that we needed. And, of course, most of the rooms in a hotel are alike. You know, so you just kind of look in and see, okay, this one's just like the one we just did. And then, you know, then across the hall, it's a mirror image. You know, and then usually then when you get down to the end or the elevators or something, then they start to change a little bit, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And so, but we spent the night there. Not at that particular hotel. We stayed at another one. And, you know, we went out to eat that night, and then we spent the night, and then we wrapped it up the next day. There was just a little bit left. And we drove back to Houston. And then, of course, you know, I downloaded all the photos and stuff. And I just was kind of glancing at them after I downloaded them. And I noticed that, and I was like, holy crap, what the hell is that? And I know that's not cigarette smoke. There were some photos where I was smoking a cigarette at the time, and you can see the smoke, you know, coming off the end of the cigarette. And of course, it doesn't look like that in that photo that you're looking at on the Blog Talk Radio page. That's really thick. That's way too thick to be cigarette smoke. Plus, you're never going to get a perfect swirl like you see there, nor are you going to get the profile of something, the head of something. You know, I don't know what that would be, but I swear that was not there when I snapped that photo. And when I started laying out the as-built plans, I really needed that photo to see what was going on. It wound up being sort of a guess. But anyway, and there's another photo that's related to a story that I'm going to read here shortly. And that particular photo has a couple at the lower front part of the photo. This was taken like a long time ago, early 20th century. I had to clear my throat. Hold on. And off to the top right, you'll see what looks like a ghost or an apparition of a small human, maybe. And according to the author of this book, that photo has been gone over very thoroughly. And it's been authenticated as not forged or faked or anything like that. So I'll let you know whenever I get to that story, and you can take a look at it when the time is right. But it's kind of eerie looking. So anyway, I got a series here and out of this book to read. So I'm just going to go ahead and dive in. This first one is called A Little Child Shall Lead Them. It says, Junior Lieutenant Igor Kuzminov, night shift supervisor of the Vologda police barracks, looked up suddenly as he heard the door to his office open. Expecting an adult, one of his patrol officers, he overlooked the child at first. Then movement, then just below his field of vision, caught his eye. The little girl was about 5 years old. She looked upset and quite excited, and she was dressed a little strangely, but as soon as she opened her mouth, the situation was more or less explained. You have to come, Tolvarik, Lieutenant, and bring the fire brigade with you, she said breathlessly. You have to come now. The barracks is burning. Her language sounded strange, stilted, as though from another time. No one used the word Tarovic, comrade, anymore. It reminded Igor of cloth caps and barricades and black leather trench coats. The child had to be from somewhere out in the provinces. What, little sister? He asked, not quite understanding what the girl said. Something about a fire, but where? The barracks is burning, comrade lieutenant. You have to come now. What barracks? We have the only barracks in the city. An orphan, he decided. That figured. The town's orphanage had many much waifs from all over the country, and that's W-A-I-F-S. It had for years, since long before Kuzminov was born. Even though Kuzminov was new at his job, he was no stranger to the region. Igor had grown up in Vologda. It was his hometown. He knew where everything was, including the state orphanage. No, comrade lieutenant, no, she gasped as she ran behind the desk, as only a child would do, and tugged at his sleeve, almost pulling him out of his chair. She was a tiny thing and thin, reinforcing Kuzminov's idea she must be an orphan. Strong for such a little one, he thought. The children's barracks, comrade lieutenant. It's on fire. You must come now. Children's barracks? Now that was one he hadn't heard in a while. That term hadn't been used since his grandfather's time. Some of the old people still called the children's home by that name, but not many, and they were rapidly dying off. Igor stood and followed the girl. Why didn't you call in or use the alarm if there's a fire? He asked. Why did you run all this way to get me? Are the lines down? What, the little girl asked. I don't know. She stopped. Never mind, comrade lieutenant. Just come now. get the fire brigade and come. She ran out of the into the night. Igor Kuzminov tried to follow her, but lost her in darkness. Probably a false alarm, he thought, but better play it safe. He stopped in the lobby and picked up the telephone. He quickly dialed 03 and told the fire brigade to go out to the children's home, that he had the report of a fire. He then roused two of his off-duty patrolmen and started toward the home himself, looking alongside of the road for the child who had alerted him. After about two blocks, he saw her. She was running toward the children's home as fast as her little legs could carry her. The oversized boots she wore seemed to glide just above the surface of the street, her feet as a blur as she ran. Her long black hair trailed in the wind behind her. Igor now dreaded what he would find. The children's home was old, very old. It had been built in the time of the Tsar, and the wooden structure had known several serious fires in its 100-plus years of existence. The last one had been around 10 years before he was born. The place had burned almost completely to the ground. That was in, he thought, about 1950. He told his driver to pull up alongside the girl and stop. He flung the door open and motioned for the little girl to get in. She ignored him and kept running. It was as though she had not seen him at all. He ordered his driver to proceed. When they arrived at the children's home, all was quiet. Everyone was asleep, and the director vehemently denied sending a child to the police barracks. The situation was serious, if it was some sort of a prank. The director summoned all of the dormitory supervisors, who in turn summoned all of the children. All were present, all except the little girl who had been in Kuzminov's office. He described the child to the assembled staff. None of them knew her. No such child is here, they informed him. Igor and the administration of the Vologda Children's Home were sorting the matter out. The fire brigade was packing to leave. It was decided, though, that since they were there anyway, they would make a routine inspection of the place just in case. They found the fire. The coal bunker beneath the old building was smoldering. It was not yet to the point of open flame, but it was burning. Left as it was, by morning the smoldering would have reached open air and burst into flame. Most likely it would have destroyed the home before help could arrive. Such fires are dangerous in another way. They produce gases once the burning hits open air. It could very well have caused a blast that would have killed everyone in the building. Another truck was summoned. The fire was extinguished, but in order to do it, the entire bunker had to be emptied. It was then that they made the discovery. The current children's home had been built, or rather rebuilt, after the disastrous fire of 1950, in which several children, the exact number was never established, and at least three staff members perished. While they had used most of the old foundation, the building was not on exactly the same spot. While digging out the coal bunker, the firemen found a set of remains most likely dating to the time of the 1950 fire. They were the remains of a little girl between the ages of 4 and 6 years old. End. This one is even shorter. This one is called Children's Laughter. My apartment building is located just across the street from an elementary school and kindergarten that have served our community for more than 70 years. Here in Russia, this isn't unusual. The school was part of Lenin's first five-year plan. It was one of the most successful parts. Late at night, long after the school is closed and completely empty, we can hear children laughing and playing in the playground. It lasts for about 5 minutes, a relatively long time. But when you look out the window, you see nothing. There are no children there. Everyone in the building is used to this. It happens several times a year and has gone on for decades, at least 50 years. So has what follows. After about 5 minutes, there is a high-pitched screeching sound followed by an explosion. The sound of children playing turns to screams and then stops. I learned from older people living in my building that during the Second World War, the playground took a direct hit from a German mortar round. About 20 children who had been in the schoolyard rather, playing at the time, died. And this next one is called "I'll Never Leave You, Mama." I think this one is a little bit longer, a couple more pages. I have a whole book here, not to worry. It was a warm and sunny day in late spring, and the two little boys had been out, like most of the local children, playing in the forest and picking berries, a common enough pastime for a pair of six-year-olds in a sleepy little Russian village. It was 1962, a tense year for the world as a whole, but not so tense for the inhabitants of Stroyidel. Having been bypassed by the recently constructed M8 motorway, it was a lethargic place, with most of the local community life centered around the usual Russian activities of work, school, the party, and the church. The old Moscow to Yaroslavl highway, the road that bisected the little city, was mostly unused now and generally served only to provide transport into Moscow for the products of the local factory, a conduit for heavy trucks laden with bricks, lumber, cement, and other items necessary to the building boom instituted a few years earlier by then Premier Nikita Khrushchev. Let me clear my throat. While it is considered a small town, Stroyidel is in fact a very little is in fact a very little more than a village, a wide spot in the narrow highway that provides housing for those who work in the local factory, the area's only major industry or place of employment. In short, it was good in Stroyidel. The two little boys crossed the old highway north of the city and started into the forest in the general direction of Taratovka, the next little village, some 5 kilometers distant. They intended to walk to Taratovka, picking berries as they went, and catch the local electric train back to the Stroyidel platform, a 2 or 3 minute ride. Sasha and Pasha, Alexander and Pavel, or Pavel, I guess, had been friends for all their short lives. They had both been born in Stroyidel, had grown up together living in the same building and adjacent flats, and that very year started school together at Public School 248. They were typical best friends and were certain they would be so for life. The trip through the woods to Taratovskaya, the railway platform serving the village of Taratovka, was without incident. The boys did have a little trouble managing the heavy bucket that now contained some 5 kilograms, the berries they had picked along the way. They were glad to get on the train, even for the 3-minute ride to their own platform, just so they could put it down and rest their tired little hands. There were live conductors in those days, announced Stroyidel platform. Of course, the boys were already aware of this fact. They picked up their bucket and left the train, along with all of their other commuters. It was now only a short walk for them. They would make it long before supper and have plenty of time to wash their berries and, of course, cram a few down as they did. 50 feet from the platform, they came to their first and only obstacle. The road leading to their block of apartments crossed the old Moscow to Yaroslavl highway just as it came out of a blind curve. The boys looked carefully both ways, then started across. They never saw what hit them. The huge Zill Truck. That's Z-I-L. I guess that is a brand in Russia. What the locals call a Tremansky, because it is a direct copy of the GMC 10-ton army trucks Truman sent to the Soviet Union on Lend-Lease, rounded the curve in a scream of brakes and blaring horns. The driver saw the two little boys, but only too late. He literally ruptured the brake lines on the heavy truck trying to stop. 10 tons of cement in 100-pound bags added to the weight of the moving truck made stopping impossible. It skewed first to the right and then to the left in a scream of tires and a cloud of dust as the driver fought for control. He tried with all his might to herd the big machine away from the two little boys and into the opposite ditch. It was an exercise in futility. With a sickening thump, the front of the Zill crashed into little Sasha Lushkov, tearing him away from Pasha, who was clear of the road surface, but only just. The driver of the truck finally stopped the vehicle. Knowing what had happened, what he had done, he jumped out from his cab and ran to the crumpled body of the little boy, now lying in a mangled heap some 20 feet from the roadbed. Little Pasha began to cry as he realized what had happened to his best friend and ran home as fast as he could. It wasn't far, not far at all. Strangely enough, Sasha was still alive when the driver found him. He remained so for several minutes, long enough for Pasha to return, leading their distraught parents. Also surprisingly, the little boy was still conscious, though barely. The local militia sergeant, who had arrived to question the driver of the truck and take the necessary statements, had already summoned an ambulance. It was, of course, too late. Little Sasha died in his mother's arms, looking up in the seeming wonder at her pain-twisted face and that of his best friend. He could hear the plea in her voice as his mother begged him not to leave, not to go away. He was unaware of his true condition, knowing only that his mother was afraid he would leave her and that she would be lonely. "Don't cry, Mama," he whispered. "You won't be lonely. I'll never leave you. I'll always be with you." Then he closed his little eyes and died. The funeral was one of the biggest in the history of Stroy Idol. It wasn't every day a child died. The schools turned out, the factory closed, everyone attended. The truck driver, who had, of course, been absolved of his part in the death, walked solemnly and silently beside the tiny casket, huge sobs racking his body as the procession wound to the cemetery. Like everyone else in Stroy Idol, he knew the family. His own children were not much older than little Sasha. 2 years passed. Another child came the spring following Sasha's death, and Pasha still stopped by the Lushkov's flat every day to say hello. Sasha's toys remained on the shelf in the living room, and his little wooden chair stood beside the kitchen table. From time to time, his little sister would play with him, but she never sat in the little wooden chair. In time, the Lushkovs decided they needed more room and began the process of moving to a slightly larger flat that had become available on a different floor of the building. As always, Pasha came over to help. They were just getting ready to make the final trip when someone noticed they had forgotten Sasha's chair. It was still standing in its usual place beside the kitchen table. Irina Lushkov, Sasha's mother, put down the load of books she was carrying and stepped back into the now empty flat. She hurried into the kitchen and grabbed the little chair, thinking to put the books in it, since it was quite tiny and not heavy, and take the entire load to the new flat all at once. When she stepped into the kitchen, she noticed the chair was gently rocking back and forth, as if someone had just been sitting there and had risen suddenly. She looked around the room. It was empty. She called out to Pasha, who had been helping them move, and asked him if he had been sitting in the chair. The boys came running back into the flat to see what his friend's mother wanted, but his answer to her question was, of course, no. He had been well out into the hallway at the time. Irina Lushkov looked around to see if her toddler, Marina, was in the room. No, also in the hallway. Strange. She reached down to pick up the little chair. At first it seemed unusually heavy and slightly cool to the touch. As she picked it up, a child's voice said, "Mama, I told you that I'd never leave you. I'll always be with you." Pasha, who was standing just behind her, also heard the voice and recognized it instantly as that of his little friend. Today, almost 40 years later, a faraway look still crosses the big man's weathered face as he tells the story. "As far as I know," he says, "Sasha is still with them. They live downstairs, you know." And let me light a cigarette here, and I'm going to play another song and clear my throat. And the next story will be the one related to the photograph that I was telling you about, of that couple in the foreground and the apparition in the upper right-hand side. So let me play this one song here, and I will be right back. Thank you. Okay, this next one is called Our Little Hero. Klizma is one of the dozens of tiny villages that make up the region known as Podmoskovye, which literally means below Moscow or outside of Moscow. It is an old place, dating to the middle of the 15th century. In recent years, however, it has become, like all of the surrounding towns and villages, a bedroom community for the capital, populated by mid- and upper-level business people and civil servants who don't mind making the 20-minute commute into Moscow in exchange for peace and quiet and good air. These new people, so to speak, reside side-by-side with families who have lived in Klizma for generations, some for centuries. In the mid-40s, a period which many people refer to as the Late Unpleasantness, Klizma had other guests who were not quite as welcome. The little town was part of a strip of land that changed hands between the Wehrmacht and the Red Army on a weekly, sometimes hourly basis. Like Monmontovka, Pushkina, and Taratovka, it sits on the Ukha River. Its value to the warring armies resided in the fact that the village was located at a natural ford, a point on the river that was shallow enough to cross without a bridge. Klizma, like most of the other villages in this area, has one main street, which is more or less paved, half a dozen tiny shops and kiosks, and about that many houses. It has a school that was built around the turn of the century, five or six apartment buildings that were constructed in the late 40s and early 50s, and a cemetery that sits off by itself on the western fringe of the village, surrounded by a grove of fir trees and connected to the town by a narrow, winding, one-lane dirt road that leads ultimately to the village church. Every afternoon, about sundown, if you pass the cemetery, you will see an elderly couple with a small girl standing within. The old couple tends a tiny grave surrounded by a wrought iron fence while the child quietly plays in the snow or in the dirt, depending on the season. They are there every day, rain or shine. It's a touching sight. The old man and woman appear to be in their late 70s, the little girl about 6 or 7. If you look closely, you will see that the man's left hand is stiff and motionless, shrouded in black leather glove. The woman helps him lift things with his artificial limb can't manage. The grave they tend has a simple monument, one of the few that has no likenesses of the deceased attached to it. Instead, it bears the simple inscription, Cherkarova Valentina Borisovna, 18th of April, 1835 through 25th of June, 1941. Beneath this line, it says simply, Our Little Hero. Around the stone, hanging by a tattered red ribbon, hangs the solid gold star of the Order of Hero of the Soviet Union. The medal does not belong to little Valentina, but it should. It was won by her father, the old man. Boris Cherkarov was foreman of the Klizma tractor factory in the wartime years. Because of his missing left hand, lost in an accident in the factory several years before the war, he was not called into the Red Army when the Germans invaded Russia in May of 1941. Instead, he and his wife, who also worked in the factory, stayed at their post with the rest of those who were either too old, too young, or too lame, kept the factory going, producing tank motors instead of tractors. Little Valentina was gathering berries on the outskirts of the village one afternoon in late June when she heard a strange sound. It sounded like the tractors her daddy's factory made, only lots of them, dozens, maybe even 100. She had never seen so many tractors before, So she climbed up on a small hill to take a look. Tanks. The first wave of the mighty German juggernaut was advancing toward Klizma and the ford of the Ukha River as part of their attempt to encircle Moscow. Valentina, of course, did not know this last part, but she knew what a tank was. She had seen them in the parades her father had taken her to in Moscow on Revolution Day. She also knew that her country was at war, although she really didn't understand exactly what war was. She saw the black crosses on the sides of the tanks and knew from what her father had told her that they were German, the Nimitzim, and she knew exactly what to do. Her daddy had told her. She had to let the village know they were coming. The village of Klizma, like all villages in the area, had an old hand-cranked siren mounted on a low platform that was used to summon the fire brigade when there was a blaze in the tiny town. It could be heard all over the surrounding area and was never used except in an emergency. Valentina jumped up and ran into the platform, which was in the center of the village. She climbed quickly up the steps and then, with all of her baby strength, swung down on the rusty crank. At first it moved slowly. She hung there in the air for a split second, her tiny feet not quite touching the ground. The crank handle was above her head, and it took all of her weight to get it to move at all. Finally, slowly, the crank began to rotate, and the siren let out its low, mournful cry. In the factory on the other side of the village, Boris, his wife, and the rest of the workers heard the sound, dropped what they were doing, and ran to investigate. Once they were out of the factory, the rumble of the tank motors was unmistakable. While Boris and most of the workers ran to get the weapons the government had left for them for just such an emergency, Valentina's mother desperately cranked the single telephone in the factory to summon help. The first 75-millimeter shell struck the signal tower just as Boris and his workers came into view. At the time, they had no idea who was giving the alarm. Nobody was ever found. Grimly, they dug in and fought off the Germans until the Red Air Force came to the rescue with a flight of Stormovik dive bombers. It was only a company, thank God, they were able to hold. In the confusion, no one thought to look for little Valentina. It was simply assumed she had hidden somewhere, as she had been taught to do so, and would come home as soon as she saw it was safe. It was not until the next day that they discovered who had sounded the alarm, and in doing so, saved the village. In the ashes and rubble of the shell crater that had once been the signal tower, a stunned father found his little girl's pail and one of her tiny shoes. Boris Chukarov won the Order of Hero of the Soviet Union that day for his part in leading his factory workers in their dogged defense of Klizma. After the war was over, he quietly hung the medal around his only child's headstone. Sit and watch as the old couple tends the grave. Watch closely as the little girl who is with them plays at their feet. Then when they go, watch little Valentina wave goodbye to their parents and slowly vanish into the mist that forms around her tiny grave. You see, the Cherkovovs can't see her. They don't know that she's there, but everyone else does. Over the years, dozens of people have seen the Cherkovov family, including little Valentina, as they cluster around the tiny grave in Klizma. Interestingly enough, in this country, people are far more open to discussing such things than they are in the West, and there is a far higher incidence of those who are willing to believe that such things not only happen, but are the natural order of things. Let me clear my throat. I first became aware of the story when the person who took the only, to our knowledge, existing photograph of Valentina Cherkarova after her death presented both the print and the negative to several friends of his who worked at the time for the Eastman Kodak Overseas Division in Moscow. His name is Alexander A. Savinov, and since his retirement from the Army several years ago, he is moonlighting as a transportation director for the Moscow Kodak warehouse. Due to his artificial hand and arm, Boris Cherkarov cannot drive an automobile. His wife, Victoria, never learned how to drive. While they never miss a day, rain, shine, sleet, or snow, visiting their daughter, the now elderly couple either walks the 3 kilometers to the cemetery or depends on the kindness of neighbors to give them a ride. On one of these occasions in the spring of 1950, Savinov, who lives in the same building with the couple, drove them out to the graveyard. As they were leaving, the small FED camera that was dangling from Sasha's belt accidentally discharged and took a single photo of the entire Cherkarov family, including little Valentina, as she stood by her neat, well-groomed grave and waved goodbye to her mother and father. When the roll of film was developed, Savinov was shocked. He had not seen Valentina nor had her parents, but there she was on film. Savinov has never shown this photo to the Cherkarov family, feeling that the sight of their daughter's spirit, since they are unaware of her presence and cannot see her, would be far too traumatic an experience for the couple. He has kept this photo to himself for almost 60 years. In May 1995, on the 50th anniversary of VE Day, a group of us were sitting around the Kodak office at the Moss Film Studio discussing events of the war. Sasha reached into his pocket and produced not only the photo, but the complete roll of negatives, then told us all the story of Valentina Cherkarov. Walter Martinovich and David Nunley and me, all of us senior executives with the Eastman Kodak Overseas Division, gaped in amazement as we not only heard this wonderful story, but saw the evidence. He then reached into his pants pocket and produced a battered FED camera, which was still quite serviceable. As a result of having not only the camera that took the photo, but both the photo and the negative, Walter Martinovich, who was then supervising the Kodak Professional Division, asked Savinov if he would mind having the in our opinion, extremely unusual photo and negatives analyzed for flaws or tampering. Savinov agreed, and the photo and negative set was turned over to Arkady, I'm not sure how that's pronounced, Kashin, who was senior laboratory technician for the Kodak Professional Laboratory at the time. In 2 days, Kashin returned the photo and negatives to us with the following report. Date of analysis, 9th of May, 1995. Subject, amorphous anomaly present in both print and negative. Result of analysis, the anomaly present in this photograph corresponds exactly to a similar anomaly present in the negative. The negative is in the 7th position on a roll of 12 exposures. No other photo in the sequence shows any sign of anomaly. A thorough analysis of the anomaly in both positive and negative indicates a semi-transparent object approximately 1 meter, 2 centimeters in height in the approximate shape of a human child. It is recognizable as the figure of a small girl dressed in the type of shroud used for burial in the early to mid-1940s. This anomaly is solidly within the focal range of the camera and is clearly a part of the target area. There is no indication of any tampering with either positive or negative, and no other frame in the film sequence shows any similar or other anomaly. An examination of the photo apparat used in making this photo reveals no flaw or defect. The photo apparat in question is a fixed focus design and incapable of being deliberately tampered with to produce such an effect with the living subject as the target. Conclusion. While it is impossible to state with any certainty the exact nature of this anomaly, it is possible to state that it is not the result of any form of tampering or any known defect of film or photo apparatus. Likewise, it is also impossible for this image to be the result of any photographer's error or deliberate act, such as improper focus. Signed, Arkady, or Arkady M. Kashin, senior engineer, photo analysis, Kodak Professional Laboratory, Moscow, Russia. Nor was that the end. Arkady Kashin, not satisfied with his own results, turned his findings, the negatives, print and camera over to a friend who must remain nameless, who is employed in the same capacity with a very large government photo analysis laboratory, which likewise, due to the sensitivity of its usual work, must remain nameless. The results were identical. After hearing this, I and several other members of our local paranormal investigative society called Angels of the Battlefield made the 20-minute commuter train ride to Klizma and ran a field investigation on the area. This included interviewing some 24 locals who all reported having seen the little girl's spirit at one time or another over a period of almost 55 years. One witness, Mrs. Elena Voroshilov, has seen the anomaly dozens of times, beginning almost immediately after the burial of the child's remains. Likewise, Major Evgeny Popov, the local militia or police commandant, has a small file box literally stuffed with reports of sightings that date back to the days of his predecessors, and he continues to gather files today. Most people here in Russia are not shy about relating this kind of occurrence, but they are reluctant to be placed in a document. It's an attitudinal thing that goes back to the Soviet days. That's one of the reasons I usually use only first and middle names in my accounts, then eventually see publication. This, though, is a rare case. Phenomenon Magazine is not published in Russia, and the use of names will not compromise any of my sources. But if I ever should compromise any of them, some of my very best sources, would dry up. Savinov and his wife are different. They have seen this particular anomaly on several occasions, as he regularly takes the family to the cemetery in bad weather. Sasha certainly does not mind talking, since it would be highly unlikely for the family to see the article. I will state, in conclusion, that I have seen this particular anomaly myself on two separate occasions other than those mentioned herein, and add the following. Original message from Walter N. Martinovic to James, and I will say his last name when I'm ready to announce the author of the book and the name of the book. Sent Wednesday, January 12, 2005, 10:48 p.m. Subject, verification. Jim, it's a pleasure to verify this article and the events that you describe. Since I've been following this since the very beginning, I think I can say that I've been completely amazed by it from the start. There is no doubt in my mind, based on the results of three different clinical examinations of the photograph and negative, that the account you present is true. Since I am personally acquainted with all of the principles to the article and the events, I can further attest that, in my opinion, all of the events related here are true. Please feel free to relay these comments to any and all interested parties. All the best. Walter N. Martinovic, General Manager, ZAO, Rhombus, Moscow, Russia. P.S. I'm glad to see that this story has a chance of being heard outside of Russia. Given the situation in the world today, a story like this has more meaning than it otherwise would. Wally. On the 5th of January, 2005, the original 1950s photograph and negatives that shows little Valentina waving goodbye to her parents was once again submitted to a complete analysis at the newly opened CGPL, or Centralnaya Gosudarstvenny Fotografisky Laboratory, which is a government agency charged with the evaluation of questionable photographs, usually those belonging to the military, weather bureau, space program, or other governmental entities. The results of that analysis were completely in keeping with earlier test results obtained by the Eastman Kodak Professional Laboratory in Moscow and those of the previously mentioned governmental organization that examined the material. After 4 days of comprehensive study, the GPL report read in part, "This photograph and his negative represent the presence of an anomaly of an unknown nature, which is completely integrated in the target area of the photograph. There is no possible question of any known type of interference or tampering with either photograph or negative. The final report is issued and signed by Dr. Vasily N. Shukhanov, General Director of the laboratory. The Cherkarovs are old now. They never had any other children. Most of those who are familiar with the story truly believe that this phenomenon demonstrates that little Valentina is simply waiting, that the appearances will stop once the family is all together again. Maybe it's just a Russian superstition. Maybe. Here in Russia, there is a saying, hope dies last. There is always hope. One day, Boris, Victoria, and their beloved Valentina will all be together again. One day they will once again be a happy little family. Boris is almost 88 years old now. Victoria is not far behind him. It won't be too much longer at all. Then if the guesses, assumptions, and hopes are right, they will all be happy again. Postscript. Boris Cherkarov passed away on the 28th of December 2004. His funeral was held 3 days later in accordance with the traditions of his faith on New Year's Eve in Klizma at the Russian Orthodox Church overlooking the cemetery where little Valentina rests. He is buried beside his beloved daughter. Mrs. Victoria Cherkarova is now 86 years of age, frail but in good health. She still visits her family at the cemetery daily. General retired Alexander Savinov, Walter N. Martinovic, and I attended both the funeral and interment. On the 10th of January 2005, the citizens of Klizma, led by Mayor Sergei K. Molodov, succeeded in having a belated Hero of the Russian Federation Medal awarded in the name of Valentina Borisinova Cherkarova. It was hung in a formal ceremony on the 9th of May 2005, Victory Day. At this time, both medals, Valentina's and her father's, along with a small brass plaque detailing the circumstances, was permanently mounted on a small monument set between their two headstones. Let me light a cigarette, and I will read the next story. That is a very interesting photograph. I don't think I've ever seen anything like that photograph before. Okay, this next one, it's just a few pages long, and let's see here, the one after it is real short as well. I'll probably read two of these, and then I'll take another short little break. This one is called A Walk in the Woods. Most Westerners are amazed by the beauty of the Russian countryside. It is nothing like the barren, frozen, snow-covered wilderness that was pictured in Cold War propaganda. Even when it is covered with snow, it is magnificent, but in the spring, it comes alive. Russians are big on nature. The floor of the forest always looks as though it had been swept. Most people in the West take less care of a graveyard than Russians do of their forest. Of course, in Russia, you can never tell when the forest is a graveyard. It is a common thing to be walking through the woods and trip over a rustling helmet or the dry-rotted, worm-eaten butt of a rifle. It is also not uncommon to happen on the rusting carcass of a tank or some other abandoned war machine. Russia lost 21 million soldiers in the Second World War, more than any other nation. The Germans buried just over 5 million in Russian soil before they finally departed after 4 years of hard-fought campaigning. Uncounted thousands lie in the forest where they fell, the faceless unknown dead, husbands, sons, and brothers remembered only by their families. Since no one knows exactly where the dead rest, the Russians have taken a pragmatic view of the matter. In every place where a battle occurred, be it a major engagement or a minor skirmish, they have placed a marker. The things pop up everywhere. Hardly a patch of forest is without one. On each one of these square concrete stones, about a meter in height and half that in width, there is a simple inscription in Russian and in German. It gives the date of the battle and the number of dead estimated to lie in the area. Campers, hikers, and picnickers happen on them all the time. It is a sobering experience. In the fall of 2000, Alexander, or Sasha, Savinov, and his family, consisting of his wife, Elena, their daughter, Alla, and grandson, little Sasha, were out for a Saturday picnic. The weather was nice, the sun was shining, and the last breath of summer was on the air. The Savinovs took to the forest, like most Russians, to enjoy the changing colors the onset of autumn always brings. Like most residents of Moscow, they sought almost any excuse to get out of the city and enjoy the fresh air. They tried to make it a different place each time. This time they went to Okolova, a tiny suburb about 20 miles northeast of the capital. This, however, would be a picnic they would always remember. About half an hour of walking, Savinov, an old soldier, called the march to a halt and broke out the food. The resting place he selected was a small clearing dominated by one of the unknown soldier monuments. Sasha has an affinity for these places. He was born about 3 months after his father was killed in action in the defense of Moscow. The body was never recovered. Let me clear my throat here. After about an hour of walking, Savinov, an old soldier, called the march to a halt and broke out the food. I already read that, sorry. Since no one was really sure where his father had fallen, Sasha had for years sought out every monument he could find and went through a little ritual. At each one, he said a little prayer and laid down a tiny Orthodox cross. He carried several of them in his pocket at all times, just in case. Sasha was in the midst of his ritual. His wife and daughter were completely engrossed in preparing the meal, and none of them were paying much attention to little Sasha, who was happily playing. The child chattered away as he played like always, nothing to be concerned about, nothing to pay special attention to. But Savinov did pay attention. This was not like the little one's normal chatter. It sounded for the world as if he were actually talking to someone. He was very serious and somber, the way he acted when he was around grown-ups. "Here," the child asked, while staring at an empty place in midair. Then he started to dig in the soft loam with his tiny hands. Savinov did not relish the idea of supervising the bath of a four-year-old who had a definite aversion to water. Baths for a little Sasha usually required chainmail gauntlets, a wire brush, and a full body armor. Without even thinking about it, he raised his head, glared at the child, and said, "Sasha, what on earth are you doing? Stop that this instant." The little boy looked up with an uncertain gaze and said, "But Papa, the soldier said that I should dig here. He said that it was important." "What soldier? I don't see anyone." "That soldier," little Sasha said, pointing to empty space just behind him. Colonel Alexander Savinov, the 26th Border Guards, retired, stood and strode over to his grandson and picked him up. "There's no one here," he said. "See? No soldier." He stepped into the place where the child had indicated. The second he did, he knew there was something wrong. The hair on his arms stood on end, and he was suddenly chilled all the way to the bone. He later said that it was like walking into a cold storage room. He literally froze in place, breathing deeply as his heart pounded. It was over in an instant. As suddenly as it came, the chill passed. The old border guard officer gently placed his grandson on the ground and looked down at him. "Where is the soldier now?" he asked. "He's gone, Papa. He went away when you walked into him. Oh. Yes, Papa, he went away. Where did he tell you to dig? The child pointed to the tiny hole he had started. Right there, Papa. He asked me to dig right there. He said it wasn't deep. What isn't deep, son? He didn't say, Papa. He just asked me to dig there. Savinov walked over to the picnic blanket with his wife and daughter head spread on the ground and picked up a large spoon. He rejoined his grandson, who was already digging again. After about 5 minutes, he uncovered the first of the remains. He told his grandson to go and get him a drink as he gently cleared the soft earth away from the rusting Soviet helmet and the skull it contained. One look was enough. He hastily covered it over again and joined his grandson at the picnic. Before leaving, Savinov deposited one of his little crosses at the site. The next morning, bright and early, he was back, this time leading a Russian Army Graves registration team. In less than half an hour, they had exhumed the remains, which were to be taken to the state mausoleum for unknown soldiers. Russian soldiers did not wear dog tags in the Great Patriotic War as their German counterparts did. Instead, they carried a small, hard plastic or metal capsule in their pockets. Inside was a little document they could fill out with their name, address, and next of kin. Most did not bother. They looked at it as an ill omen, a self-fulfilling prophecy. This soldier had been no different, another nameless body to be claimed by the state. About a week later, Savinov was sitting in his little room, his living room, watching television when little Sasha came up and tugged on his arm. "What is it, son?" he asked. "Look, Papa," the child said excitedly. "Here's the soldier who talked to me in the woods." Savinov, puzzled, looked down at his grandson. In the child's hand was an aging black-and-white photo. It showed a man in his late 20s in the uniform of a Soviet border guard captain. It was Captain Alexandrovich Savinov, Sasha's father. He stared at the photo and his grandson in complete silence for a long time. And, okay, this next one here is rather short. I may read one more before I take a break. These are all real short here, unlike the ones I read last week. This one is called Playmate. All children, or almost all of them, go through a stage in which they invent imaginary playmates. Russian children are no different from many others in that respect. Victor and Katya Boikia's little girl, Vika, certainly wasn't. When Vika was about 5 years old, she constantly talked to her parents about her friend Natasha. Of course, her parents didn't pay much attention to her. They thought it was funny, except for one thing. Natasha was always hungry. Vika would go to the kitchen and raid the refrigerator, cookie jar, or bread bin for food for Natasha. Vika, unfortunately, takes after her father, who is a short, stocky man with a tendency to gain weight rapidly. So after a while, Victor and Katya began to grow a little concerned. Although Vika showed no signs of weight gain, the volume of food she was consuming was alarming. One evening in the summer of 2003, about 10 o'clock, Vika, who should have been long asleep, was in the process of making one of her raids when her mother stopped her and confronted her. "You shouldn't be eating at this hour, you know. It isn't good for you." "It's not for me, Mama. It's for Natasha," Vika beamed. "She's always hungry." "Well," Katya Boika said somberly, "you tell Natasha that it isn't good to eat at this hour. She'll have to wait until morning like the rest of us." "All right, Mama," Vika nodded. "I'll tell her." The next evening it was the same, about 10 o'clock, half an hour after Vika had been put to bed. Once again she was in the kitchen foraging for food for Natasha. Once again her mother sent her back to her room and with a stern admission concerning Natasha's late night eating habits. "Bad enough in the daytime," Katya told Victor as they settled back into continue watching television. From down the hall, they could hear Bica's voice as she delivered the message to her imaginary friend. Not too long after that, Victor's father passed away. The family traveled to St. Petersburg for the funeral and to help tie up loose ends. St. Petersburg is a lovely city, a tourist mecca, and the traditional capital of the Russian Tsars. It is known under the name Leningrad throughout the world for having withstood a three-year-long siege by the Germans during the Second World War. More than half the population died in the siege of Leningrad, mostly from disease and starvation. Shortly after their arrival and Victor's boyhood home, Vika began to explore the flat. She had been there before, but with the adults so preoccupied, she now had a more or less free run so long as she didn't break anything, about which she had been sternly warned. Vika was a curious child, and the big flat on Nevsky Prospect was fascinating to her. It had been in her father's family for many years and was filled with mementos of generations past. No one paid much attention to her for about an hour until she came running up to her mother shouting and waving a small framed photograph. "Mama, look, it's Natasha. What is her picture doing here in Grandfather's flat?" Shock, horror, and realization crossed Katya Boyka's face as she looked at her daughter and then at the aging photo. It was an old family portrait taken shortly before the Second War. Victor had shown it to her once. In it, among others, were Victor's grandparents, whom he had never met, along with his father and his aunt, who had died during the siege of Leningrad some 50 years before, at the age of 5, of starvation. This next one is called The Little Drummer Boy. I don't think it has anything to do with the one that's told around Christmas time. This one is short. I'll read it and then play some more music. It was in the winter of 1882, the date quite well known, January 16th. A new czar sat in the Kremlin, and all of Russia was full of hope. Nicholas II seemed to be the exact opposite of his late unlamented father. He was already instituting a program for strengthening Russia, not the smallest part of which was the creation of a series of schools for young men with ambitions of being civil servants or professional military officers. One of those new schools was located in the city of Taratovsk, about 20 miles north of Moscow. A new semester had just begun. The students had only gathered for classes the previous week. It was a place of hope and dreams. It was a place of learning. It almost became a place of tragedy. The fire started without warning, with no apparent cause. It began in the stable and spread quickly, as fires usually do when buildings are constructed of pine. In no time at all, it engulfed the neighboring outbuildings, the main school building, and within a matter of only a few minutes, the entire Taratovskaya gymnasium. Less than 100 yards away from the conflagration was the dormitory, separated from the main part of the school by a small parade ground. The 200 students all slept soundly, blissfully ignorant of the encroaching inferno. It was wintertime, and the heat of the blaze did not penetrate the chilled air and snow to give warning of what was to come. By the time there was enough heat to alert those in the dormitory, it would most likely be too late for the warning to do any good. In fact, it almost was. The gymnasium's youngest students, boys between the ages of 8 and 10, were housed on the ground floor of the three-story dormitory. Among this group were the gymnasium's two drummer boys. Since they had to rise half an hour before the rest of the students in order to drum them to the dining hall, they lived slightly apart in a tiny closet-sized room next to the dormitory's master's quarters on the far end of the building, the end farthest from the blaze. No one knows exactly what happened. Some call it a miracle. Whatever it was, something woke young Dmitry Petrenko. Maybe it was a dream. Perhaps it was a call of nature. No one knows. What they do know is this. In the early hours of the morning of January 16, 1882, Dmitry Petrenko awoke to the smell of smoke and the specter of a building ablaze. By that time, the fire had already bridged the gap between the main school building and the dormitory, and the building was ablaze and burning furiously. The sleeping students had to be roused. A warning had to be given. Dima didn't waste time getting dressed. Even at his young age, he knew that going door to door would take too much time, and time was one thing he did not have. Without thought for his own safety, he quickly pulled on his trousers and boots, grabbed his drum, and started down the hall. Beating the only call he had so far learned, the mess call, down one corridor, then the next, up the stairs, coughing and choking on the greasy black smoke as he struggled forward, sounding the alarm, to the second floor, then the third. One by one, doors opened, windows opened, and the sleeping boys roused. Most escaped unharmed or only slightly injured, all except Dima Petrenko. When the fire had burned itself out, his charred body and the metal fittings of his drum were found in the ashes of what had been once the stairwell. He had died in the noblest manner possible. That's what Tsar Nicholas said when he laid the headstone on Dima's grave in the courtyard of the rebuilt gymnasium just over a year later. Taratovska, however, had not seen or heard the last of Dmitry Petrenko. Even today, when there is a fire in the little town late at night, when there is a danger, it will be discovered too late. The entire town is wakened by the sound of a drum. It rattles through the night in a staccato beat that every citizen recognizes, a solitary drum echoing through the darkness, beating what old military people readily recognize as the mess call. The old gymnasium is gone now, torn down years ago to make room for a more modern structure, the third to stand on the site. The little grave, however, is exactly the same, lovingly tended by all the citizens of the town, and now enclosed within a tiny wrought iron fence. There are always fresh flowers on the little grave, and it is always spotlessly clean. His medal, the Order of St. George, still hangs on the stone around the little porcelain plaque that bears his likeness. And let me play another song. I'll take a little short break, and I will be right back. Thank you. Okay, I'm back. The Little Girl in the Garden is the name of this next one. I moved out to Mamontovka in 1991. Up until that time, I had lived in Moscow, and then I came out to our country house on weekends. I liked living in the country, although it does, especially in the winter, have its drawbacks. In the spring and summer, I usually walk the 2 kilometers from our house to the railway platform and take the train into the city. It's a beautiful walk, and I like being out in the fresh air. Besides, the train is faster than driving, since the traffic on the M8 is absolutely awful. In any case, I know everyone who lives alongside Kutuzovsky Prospect, our main street, and the one leading to the platform. Mr. A.A. Shugapov and his grandfather live in the house next to the school, about a half a kilometer up the road from my own house. I see them out in their garden almost every day as I walk along. Mr. Shugapov is in his late 80s and very spry for a man his age. He is known for having the best garden in Mamontovka. His granddaughter is about 5. An adorable little girl with braided long blonde hair and a face full of freckles. You know the kind. All knees and elbows, long legs and arms, not quite out of the baby stage. She makes a funny sight, kneeling there in the garden wearing a frayed old worker's jacket over her cute little blue dress and a pair of her grandfather's old army boots that swallow her tiny legs. Every morning you can see Anna or her grandfather in the garden working around the plants. When I first moved here, I didn't know them. We only waved to each other as I passed their ancient log house with the beautiful gingerbread around the windows under the eaves. One Saturday morning, late in March of 1992, I decided to take the train into Moscow and do a little shopping. I didn't have to work that day, which was unusual back then, and I wanted to take advantage of the free time. As I neared his house, I could see Mr. Shugapov standing out by the road, waiting for the mail truck. I decided to stop and talk with him for a moment and get to know him. I had already heard about his fine vegetable crops and award-winning potatoes. We had a nice chat, and then I asked him about his granddaughter. Actually, I asked him who the cute little girl was who was so diligent in helping him in his garden. The old man looked at me like I had 2 heads. There was a genuine look of shock in his face. He smiled thinly, then said, "You have seen my granddaughter?" "Yes," I replied. "I see her almost every morning. I walk this way going to the train, and we wave to each other across the fence." "That is quite impossible," he replied, looking at me a little strangely. "Are you sure that you've seen her?" Something wasn't quite right. I was at a loss for words. Then I described the little girl I saw every morning, thinking that it might be a neighbor child who had taken to helping the old man. "Oh, that's my Anna," he said. "But she isn't my granddaughter. She's my daughter." "Your daughter?" I was startled. Judging from the old man's obvious age, that seemed a little far-fetched to me, but I had learned long ago to never be surprised by such things. In Russia, all things are possible, and May-December marriages are the rule rather than the exception. Extreme age differences are rare, but not unheard of. About 15 years is the average. And by the way, I just want to interject, that used to be very normal. My grandfather was 15 years older than my grandmother was. It was not uncommon at all. Back going back to like the before the middle of the 20th century, I would say, and back further, it was very normal. Before I could make any further comments, the old man invited me inside for coffee and a little something to warm you up. Of course, I accepted. It was March. There was still a little chill in the air. I followed him inside and had a seat as he retreated to the kitchen to prepare our snack. I looked around his living room as I sat there on his overstuffed leather sofa. As I did, I marveled at the little shrine he had erected to his beautiful little girl. There were pictures of her everywhere. It was odd, though, since they were all in black and white, and some of them looked quite old. In a few minutes, he returned bearing a hand-painted wooden tray on which sat two cups of tea, a teapot, sugar, and a small pitcher of cream. Under his arm was a bottle of vodka with two glasses balanced on the neck. He placed the tray on a small table in front of the divan, then set the glasses down and started opening the vodka. He pointed to a framed picture of his daughter on the table. It had been taken in the garden, and she was dressed exactly as she was every time I saw her. "That's her," I said. "Beautiful, a beautiful child. You are a lucky man." "Yes, she was beautiful, wasn't she?" he said, a faraway look clouding his face. He poured the vodka slowly into the glasses, then handed one to me. "You're going to need this," he said. "What do you mean, Mr. Shugapov?" I asked. "What do you mean was lovely? I'm sorry, what you mean was lovely. She is a beautiful little girl. How old is she, 5 or 6? "She was 5, he paused. "On her last birthday, she was 5. "I don't follow you, sir. What are you saying?" The old man downed his vodka in one gulp, then told me, "Drink, then I will explain." I took my vodka the same way he did. Then he looked at me and said, "Dima, that's how I'm known here. Dmitri is the Russian equivalent of James, or one of them, anyway. My Anna had her last birthday in October of 1935. I loved her more than my own life. We did everything together. She died of typhus before her next one came around, with her mother, but she's never left me. I just thought." He paused and took another shot of vodka, this time straight out of the bottle. "I just thought that I was the only one who could see her." And okay, this next one is called Always. And there's several short ones here. This book is divided into different sections. I kind of just picked a spot and just started reading. I kind of jumped around last show, and I'll we'll probably get through this book the way it looks before Samhain, or also known as Halloween. Again, this one is called Always. Let me relight this cigarette here. It just won't stay lit. I got a fan blowing on me. Says Novi Davici Convent is probably one of the most visited places in Moscow. The convent itself has been closed ever since the Civil War of the 1920s. It is only now undergoing the ground-up restoration necessary to once again make it a functioning cloister. What makes it a tourist attraction is the cemetery. For years, this vast, sprawling graveyard has been the last resting place for not only the common man, but for the rich and famous who were not quite important enough in life to be buried beneath the Kremlin wall. Here you will see the graves of Nikita Khrushchev, both of Stalin's wives, the family of Yakov Sverdlov. Also buried here are state heroes like Mayakovsky, the playwright, Alexei Tolstoy, Nikolai Gogol, the famous authors, and those who were killed in the crash of the Maxim Gorky at the time in the early 1930s. the largest airplane in the world. In their own little section, slightly away from the rest, lie the war heroes, Ivan the Terrible, Kozadub, the highest-ranking fighter ace ever to live, Admiral Yuri Gorshkov, father of the modern Russian nuclear navy, and others. Here is where Yuri Nukulin, the greatest clown in Eastern Europe, rests. There are also the common folk, average, run-of-the-mill people who have no particular claim to fame. Each rests beneath the marker, which is typical Russian style. In typical Russian style, bears either a likeness or a bust, sometimes a full statue of the departed. In the walls surrounding the cemetery are tiny recesses that hold the urns of those cremated. Each place bears a tiny porcelain plaque with a portrait of the deceased. In front of each grave, also in typical Russian style, is a tiny bench on which visitors may sit and have a drink or simply rest while communicating with their loved ones. The cemetery at Novi Divichi is old and laced with tiny trails and paths among the graves and between the sections. Each day, hundreds of people wander here. There are even tours given of the grounds. Every day, the tourists and other visitors marvel at one old couple. Both appear to be in their 70s or 80s, and they stroll through the cemetery arm in arm, oblivious to the stares of the onlookers. Although both are slightly stooped with age, they walk erect, silently chatting and occasionally stopping to take in the view or to look over one of the many busts or portraits. It is a heartwarming experience to watch them. They are so obviously in love, and it is so obviously a love that has endured for many years. Beauty and youth are long departed, yet they look upon each other as if for the first time. The years and the rigors of life have taken their toll, yet they are still seemingly infatuated with each other, holding back each other close like a pair of teenagers in the grip of their first crush. They are dressed neatly, somewhat formally. No one wears a suit and tie to tour Novi Divichi. They do. No one gives it a thought. Such things are common among the aged in this country, a place in which any outing, no matter where or what kind, is looked upon as a time to look the best. All day long they stroll the vast necropolis as if they have all the time in the world. They do. No one has ever seen them leave the cemetery. They do not take the last tour bus. They do not walk at closing time to the trolley stop or bus park. They never go to the curb to wait for the tram. They do, however, go home, and many have seen this. As the last rays of the sun settle on the quiet cemetery, as the last tourists crowd onto the waiting buses, as the caretakers prepare to close Novi Divichi Convent for the night, Mr. and Mrs. Igor Dobrynin slowly and silently take a seat in the shade on a tiny bench beside a tiny stone that bears the simple inscription, "Always," along with the dates of birth and death in a portrait of the old couple as they looked when they were young. As the gates close, they can be seen slowly vanishing, going back into the cold earth that holds their mortal remains and has ever since they died on the same day more than 30 years ago. On May 19, 1975, Igor Dobrynin woke at his usual time to find that his beloved wife had left him in the night. She died peacefully in her sleep of an apparent heart attack. After 41 years together and unable to face the idea of the countless years facing him without his beloved Irina, Igor Dobrynin joined her in death by gassing himself with a cook stove in their tiny East Moscow flat. Now they are together again. They are and will be together always. And this next one is called Angel of the Morning. This one is real short, and the one after that is real short. I can probably definitely get these in before the end of the two-hour broadcast. I don't know how far I will keep reading for sure on this, but There's the rest of these stories here that are next in line are all real short. We'll see how far I'll go when I get to that point. Angel of the Morning is the next one. This is not meant to sound ghoulish, but if you've never been to a Russian cemetery, you don't know what you've missed. In Russia, a cemetery is not only a place for the dead to rest, but also a place to commemorate their lives and provide solace for the living. Every plot has its little bench to provide a resting place for visitors. People in Russia, as a rule, do not forget their dead. Many traditions surround death and burial in Russia. One of them is the idea that the soul does not depart from the earth for 40 days after burial. And I'm going to interject something here. That is not an unusual belief either. There's a lot of reason to believe that it really is actually the case. And if you've understand any of my shows that I've done on spirituality, and also too, one day I will get into some topic similar to this at some point coming up. I don't know when or what or exactly, but it's just now that I've read this, it just kind of hit me all of a sudden that I do have some things I'd like to share at some point. The story goes on that the soul, not wanting to admit that it is dead, will continue to visit its corpse and its former home until obvious deterioration convinces it that a return to the body is impossible. The traditional period of 40 days arises from the fact that Russia has a very cold climate, and a body that is buried takes at least that long to noticeably deteriorate, since the ground temperature at a depth of 6 feet or so is always near freezing. While bodies are buried immediately in Russia, the Russian Orthodox Church opposes embalming and mummification. The commitment and the dedication of the grave marker takes place only after the traditional 40-day period, allowing the soul to be departed to pass on into the next world. About 5 years ago, in the winter of 1996, a young woman from Mamontovka died rather suddenly. She was quite young, about 16 years old, when she died, and very beautiful. She died in an automobile crash when the car she was riding in went over a bridge railing and into the Oka River. A devout young woman, she and some friends were on their way home from a church function in nearby Pushkina. The driver of the car, her boyfriend, and two other passengers survived the crash. Her family was devastated. While not rich, managed to erect a full-size statue of their beloved and only daughter at the site of her grave. It depicts the girl as an angel, kneeling and holding a bunch of wild flowers. For weeks after she died, both her parents and her distraught boyfriend were plagued with the notion she was still with them. Strange things would happen around the house. Items that had belonged to her would be found lying out as if recently used. In the mornings, her bed would be rumpled as if someone had lain on it during the night. They would hear footsteps coming from her room and the faint sound of a girl crying. At times, both parents would swear they had caught a glimpse of their daughter out of the corner of their eye, watching them go about the lives they longed to share. They went grudgingly on with their lives and simply chalked all of these happenings up to grief. Her boyfriend also seemed to see her, or at least sense her, everywhere. Like her parents, he would catch himself looking over his shoulder constantly and walking, quite shaken from a sound sleep after hearing her voice in his room or feeling her touch him in the night. Finally, 40 days after her funeral, came the time to dedicate her marker. The parents, the extended family, friends, and the village priest all journeyed to Mamontovka Cemetery for the traditional Russian Orthodox ceremony of committal and dedication. The beautiful statue was covered with a drape. Finally, after the last prayer was said and the last of the incense fumes had vanished into the warm spring air, the priest reached up and pulled a cord that dropped the drape. There, for all to see, was the beautiful statue of the angel, and there were tears in her eyes, real tears. But from that point on, the hauntings stopped. And this next one is called 6 Years Old. This was translated by the author of this book with permission. It says, author's name withheld upon request. It says, the following poem was written by a friend who asked that it be included in this collection. The incident occurred on September 17, 1999 at the Moscow Zoo. Like all other stories in this collection, it is a true account of an actual incident. I took my children to the park, and there we met a man who looked at us with longing, lonely eyes. I have a little boy, he said. He's 6 years old. He always will be 6 years old. He smiled and looked away. I bring him here most every afternoon to watch the other children run and play. It's been so long since he could play their games, but he can watch and not get in their way. He loves it so. His eyes were filled with tears. I guess it's nice to be just 6 years old, unchanging. Always 6 years old, forever, throughout all the countless years. He knelt and grasped a tiny unseen hand, and then he stood and looked back up at me. The old man smiled again. Then we said, good day. I gathered up my own kids, turned my back, and as they watched, we slowly walked away. And the next one is called I'll Wait For You. It was the summer of 1994, and Nikolayevich was dying. He knew he was, and he was ready to go. He had cancer. Dying was all right with Nikolai. He was 94 years old, and he had outlived all of his family, all of his friends, and most of his relatives. In his long life, he had seen the world change in many ways he did not understand, could not fathom, and did not like. The cancer, in fact, had come as a sort of perverse blessing. He had long before made his peace with the powers that be. Now, as he lay in his bed, surrounded by his doctor and two of his grandchildren, in the comfort of the neat little flat he had shared for more than 60 years with his wife, Olga, he had nothing to do but wait. He had declined pain medication. It wasn't so bad. He had many times in his life experienced worse. At least the doctor had allowed him to come home to die. He could not bear the thought of leaving the world in a sterilized, sanitized, and frigid environment of the hospital. Here, at least, he could spend what little time was left to him amid his own things in the place that had been his home for more than two-thirds of his life. The old carpenter was wasted, a shadow of his former self. Only his large, calloused hands showed any evidence of the strength that had once been his. He had never been a large man, and the sheets, clean and crisp, and the blankets made him look even smaller than his 5 feet 4 inches. Of course, the cancer had taken its toll, and the extra weight that he once carried had long since melted away. Still, his eyes were bright, his mind clear, and his intellect keen. Every 5 minutes or so, his oldest granddaughter, Elena, would gently brush an unruly lock of snow-white hair away from his forehead, smooth his brushy eyebrows, and ask the old man if he needed anything. From the look on his face, what he needed the most was to be left alone. Of course, he would never tell the girl this. He simply shook his head and said in a weak voice that he was fine the way he was. The younger girl, Natasha, sat quietly beside the bed, occasionally glancing at the wall above the headboard where an old photograph of Nikolai Nikolayevich and his late wife hung in a handmade wooden frame. The old man glanced up at the girl and caught her staring at the picture. You look a lot like her, you know, he smiled weakly and reached for her hand as he spoke. the same eyes, the same smile. "Save your strength, Grandfather," she said softly. "You have to conserve your strength." "Why, your grandmother will be here for me soon." "What are you talking about, Grandfather?" "Your grandmother," the old man replied softly. "She's coming for me. She promised me that she would." Both girls had been present when their grandmother passed away. Both of them had heard the old woman make that promise to her nearly frantic husband. She had done it to calm him. They both knew that. Now it looked as though the old man was living some sort of fantasy. Did he really believe this? Surely not. That day ended, as did the next. With each passing hour, Nikolaevich grew weaker and weaker. Finally, after 10 weary days, it looked as though the end was near. He stopped eating. Elena and Natasha had both suggested putting him back in the hospital. The old man was weak, but he still had his wits about him. He simply would not hear of it. The priest was called. He came and went. Nikolai slept all through the 12th day. The doctor came, shook his head, and left. There was nothing more he could do. The old man's breath grew shallower and shallower, but still he held on. Neither girl left his bedside. Neither expected him to wake from his sleep. Then in the small hours of the morning on the 13th day, he rallied. Both girls, well, they were hardly girls, but that's what he called them. They both had grown children, and one had a grandchild of her own. Both had nodded off into a fitful sleep, so they didn't notice at first. Then they heard his voice, not the voice of the old sick man they had come to comfort in his dying, but the voice they remembered from childhood, a strong, firm voice. Elena and Natasha looked up to see the room bathed in a gentle glow. Their grandfather was sitting bolt upright, looking intently at the door across the dining room from his foot of his bed. He spoke again. "So you've come," he said, a smile lighting up his lined face. "I knew you would. I was waiting for you. I told you that I would wait, remember?" The young woman in the doorway smiled back at him and said, "Yes, darling, I remember. And now I've come for you. It's time for you to go." The two girls sat frozen in their chairs, unable to speak or move. Both saw the young woman. Both recognized her. She was younger than they remembered, but she looked exactly like she did in the picture hanging above the bed, dressed in the style worn at the turn of the century. Her chestnut hair was long and flowing, and there was a look of gentle concern on her face. She looked solid enough, but not quite real. She glided across the floor to the side of the bed and took the old man by the hand. "Come, darling," she said. "It's time." "Past time," he replied. "Long past time." With that, he laid back gently onto his pillow and heaved a deep sigh. The glow faded, and before Elena and Natasha's startled eyes, the woman vanished. As if a spell was broken, both reached for the bed. The old man lay there, still, his eyes closed, a smile on his face, quite dead. Okay, let's see here. There's several more I could read, but we're getting pretty close to the two-hour point. I think I will go ahead and just save these for one more show. So let me go ahead and play a song to go out with, and I'll do another one of these shows like this within the next two or three days max here, I hope anyway. Hopefully nothing will come up that will prevent me from doing so. Anyway, until next time.